Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is William Stukeley, the renowned archaeologist who drew attention to Stonehenge and Avebury and other stone circles and megalithic sites and pointed out their connection to the Druids and inspired a great revival in prehistoric learning. This is part two, and my co-host, as always, is Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we move into our Greatest Britons now then, Max, do you think?
Yeah, we can do that.
Let's talk some more about William Stukeley. Last episode, we talked about how Stukeley drew his interpretations of Britain's megalithic remains from earlier sources. He did not claim to be given divine revelation about them. He believed the Druidic understanding of the world came through scientific study in the same way. He traced the Druids to Phoenician settlers, which ties in with the earliest British legends about settlers arriving from Syria and giving their name to the county of Surrey. He thought the Britons were a chosen nation, and that the Church of England had special favour from God. He criticised Britons who went abroad on a grand tour when they could stay within their own country and see the evidence that Britain was a central civilising power long before Rome, just from the size of Avebury, Silbury Hill and Stonehenge. And it is interesting that at the time, there were authors that were trying to claim that Stonehenge and Avebury had actually been built by the Romans. And it was Stukeley that was saying, well, no, these were built by people before the Romans. And it shows that we had a certain level of technology in Britain that they didn't actually have in Europe. It shows we were far advanced from a lot of Europe. When you look at the size of some of these stones, it's just incredible that they were actually able to maneuver them about. And we also talked a little bit about the imminent godhood and the religious side of things, because he was basically tying in religious ideas and Christian ideas in with pagan ideas and presenting Stonehenge and Avebury as megalithic structures representative of those ideas. And he really did sort of set off a renewed interest in Druidry. You could say that he was the expert in Druidry of his day. And then onwards from him, there became a renewed interest in pre-Christian British religion and also in the megaliths and the stones, which he popularised. I don't know if there was anything else that you want to bring up, Max, or highlight that we were talking about in the earlier episodes.
Well, really, just emphasising what you've been saying there about his ideas, creating this sort of melding of Christianity and also Druidry, and as you said, the idea of immanence as far as the Almighty is concerned, as far as a deity is concerned, that's something which is an idea which in more recent times has started to factor in religious ideas. If we look at organizations in the United States, there's the National Alliance over there, which has created the Cosmotheist Community Church, and where one of the main ideas of their church is of the immanence of the life force, effectively.
And I also think I want to highlight the fact that he was drawing attention to the Britishness of Druidry and the Britishness of early Christianity, and laying claim to both of those as being an essential part of Britain's heritage. Because at the time, the church was splitting apart from Roman Catholicism, and the Church of England was starting to gather a sense of its own national pride. And he was tying that in with pre-Christian Druidry, with those beliefs as well, and just having a sense of pride in being British, which we don't have today, because they try to say that, we really didn't know very much until the Romans came. Whereas what he was saying is we knew a lot, and actually we were equals with the Romans? Well, I found a piece on Wikipedia about Avebury itself and Stukeley and how he set about trying to prevent the destruction of the stones, which I thought was quite interesting. In the latter part of the 17th and then the 18th centuries, destruction at Avebury reached its peak, possibly influenced by the rise of Puritanism in the village, a fundamentalist form of Protestant Christianity that vehemently denounced things considered to be pagan, which would have included pre-Christian monuments like Avebury. The majority of the standing stones that had been a part of the monument for thousands of years were smashed up to be used as building material for the local area. This was achieved by lighting a fire to heat the sarsen stone, then pouring cold water onto it to create weaknesses in the rock, and finally smashing at the fire-cracked rock with a sledgehammer. I mean, this is absolute Bolshevism that was going on here. You have to remember that at first they did this to the churches and the monasteries, and they destroyed the old churches and monasteries because they said that they were full of papistry and idolatry. And then after that, they moved on to smashing up Avebury and Stonehenge. I mean, this mentality has always been there amongst us, this Luddite mentality of wanting to just destroy beauty and things that we don't understand from the past. So it's very sad that this was going on. It reached its peak in the 17th and the 18th century.
And interesting that we've criticised ISIS in more recent times for doing the same thing out in Syria and at sites of historic interest in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's the same mentality, isn't it? There's a certain section amongst us that just wants to destroy rather than building. In 1719, the antiquarian William Stukeley visited the site where he witnessed the destruction being undertaken by the local people. Between then and 1724, he visited the village and its monument six times, sometimes staying for 2 or 3 weeks at the Catherine Wheel Inn. In this time, he made meticulous plans of the site, considering it to be a British temple and believing it to having been fashioned by the Druids, the Iron Age priests of northwestern Europe in the year 1859 BC. He developed the idea that the two inner circles were a temple to the moon and to the sun, respectively, and eventually came to believe that Avebury and its surrounding monuments were a landscaped portrayal of the Trinity, thereby backing up his erroneous ideas that the ancient Druids had been followers of a religion very much like Christianity. And I would contend that his ideas were not erroneous. There were a lot of similarities between Druidry and Christianity. In actual fact, it was the same name of a god. They called their god Yisu, the Druids did, and they didn't actually change the name of the god once the god became known as Jesus. And I think he was quite correct. I mean, Stonehenge was built round about the year 1859 BC. I think they say it was round about 2000 BC, 2500 BC. And, you know, just the size of it is absolutely incredible. There was nothing else that was being built like that at the time. The only thing you have close to it is the pyramids in Egypt. I think Silbury Hill is the largest man-made structure in the whole of Europe. And again, that was built around about 2000 BC. I guess people had looked at them before, and where they'd fallen out of use, they didn't really know what they were for. So by saying that these structures were temples, that was a new idea at the time. So I guess that was quite revolutionary in his thought. Well, Stukeley was disgusted at the destruction of the sarsen stones in the monument, and he named those local farmers and builders who were responsible. He remarked that this stupendous fabric, which for some thousands of years had braved the continual assaults of weather, and by the nature of it, when left to itself, like the pyramids of Egypt, would have lasted as long as the globe, hath fallen a sacrifice to the wretched ignorance and avarice of a little village unluckily placed within it. And, I mean, it still goes on today. I mean, in Wales, they've got megalithic structures. You've got dolmens, which are like 2 or 3 large stone uprights with a capstone on the top of it. And you look at them and you think, well, they've been stood there for thousands of years without falling down. And then you get an organisation like CADU, which is the Welsh equivalent of English Heritage, and they'll put these awfully positioned stone brickwork, basically things as if they're needed to hold up the capstone, or they'll put concrete reinforcing in there in order to hold the capstone up. And it just seems ridiculous to me that our ancestors built these things, and they've stood there for thousands of years, and then somebody today from some government organization thinks, oh no, that's dangerous, we can improve upon that, we'll put a stonework structure underneath it to try and hold the top up, when all it needs is to be resting on the three points of the uprights. So I think
health and safety, isn't it?
Yeah, health and safety. It's just ridiculous. You know, you think these things have stood there for thousands of years, they've managed against all the weather and what have you, and they've survived that. But will they survive the ignorance of the people that live there? As he says here in Avebury, the village itself, they started smashing them up, and as I'm pointing out here as well, even the health and safety people today end up damaging them. Well, Stukeley published his findings and theories in a book, Avebury, a Temple of the British Druids, in 1743, in which, it says here, he intentionally falsified some of the measurements he had made of the site to better fit his theories about its design and purpose. And I guess you could say there was just an artistic license rather than intentionally falsifying things. Meanwhile, the Reverend Thomas Twining had also published a book about the monument, Avebury in Wiltshire, the Remains of a Roman Work, which had been published in 1723, whereas Stukeley claimed that Avebury and related prehistoric monuments were the creations of the Druids, Twining thought they had been constructed by the later Romans, justifying his conclusion on the fact that Roman writers like Julius Caesar and Tacitus had not referred to stone circles when discussing the Iron Age Britons, whereas late medieval historians like Geoffrey of Monmouth and Henry of Huntingdon had described these megaliths in their works, and that such monuments must have therefore been constructed between the two sets of accounts. So we can see there where these mistakes can easily be made. Because the Romans didn't write about them, they must not have existed at that time. But that's like saying, because nobody wrote about the fossils of the dinosaurs, they never existed until the last century. You know, just because people haven't written about something that's there doesn't mean that they haven't always been there. They were just taken for granted, I guess. And you can see that there's this argument about when were these stone circles actually created. And I don't think they can be that accurate today, because you can't tell how old a stone is or when a stone was actually put in place. I mean, they can dig around and they can say, well, we've found these seeds or these remains of food from, and we can trace that back to whenever that was. But that doesn't tell us when those stones were actually erected. I think probably about 2000 BC. I mean, some of these stones, they say, that were put up like 7,000 years ago. And you just think, well, how was that possible? And we would still have difficulties doing it today with, with mechanics and cranes, let alone doing it with donkeys or on horseback like they were back then.
So constantly, the technique that's used for dating these things is improving. I can remember when the only way of dating things was carbon 14, but now there's a lot of rock substances contain isotopes which have got a sort of radioactive half life, and you can calculate how long a piece of stone has been exposed to the air, and that gives you a way of dating the stone. And a lot of the skeletons that have been found over the last couple of hundred years of Paleolithic and earlier skeletons of people that lived in those far off days, you know, the dating of those has changed significantly as each method of dating from a chemical or a physical perspective has been improved, and I think that it's fairly evident that those stones do predate by a considerable period of time the appearance of the Romans.
Definitely,
I don't think that can be doubted now.
Definitely, but this was a topic of discussion that was going on in the 18th century. That, you know, there was still arguing about this, claiming that it was the Romans that had actually built them. Well, Stukeley placed an emphasis on measuring and recording historical sites and encouraged his various correspondents to do the same. He engaged in excavation by digging in and around archaeological sites, relating that doing so was like an anatomical dissection. He recognized the principle of stratigraphy, that different layers of soil reflected different periods in the development of a site. So he was quite important for archaeology, really. I mean, taking these plans and drawing them exactly as they were, these stone circles, knowing that they were being smashed up at quite a rate of knots, and also working out that when he was digging through them, it had to be looked at like an anatomical dissection of a body, because he was also an anatomical doctor, and he had also dissected bodies from the gallows. So he was looking at doing the same thing with these archaeological sites. I mean, Britain is really big in the archaeological scene. If you look back at the early archaeologists, particularly when we had the British Empire, we would go out and we would look at these sites of historical importance that had just been ignored for thousands of years by the people that were living there, and we would dig them up and look through the layers of soil and find out everything we could about history. Like L.A. Waddell discovered the birthplace of the Buddha. We had Flinders Petrie, our great Egyptologist. We had people out in Assyria, in Nineveh, in Syria, all British archaeologists that were discovering this hidden history. And it all took place within the British Empire. I mean, I'd like to do Flinders Petrie as one of our greatest Britons eventually. Pigott described Stukeley as a gregarious creature who enjoyed conversation and being flattered. And Pigott is his most recent autobiographist. There have been some biographies that have been written of Stukeley recently, and Pigott's is the main one. Haycock referred to Stukeley's amiable personality, while Pigott also highlighted an immensely likable quality to Stukeley's personality, as evidence highlighting that when the Reverend was laid up in bed in Queen's Square on one occasion, over 120 friends and parishioners either visited him or sent him a message of sympathy. He also regarded the antiquary as displaying a charm and pleasant oddness, as well as a cheerfulness and disarming ingenuousness. Pigott also noted that in later life, Stukeley became self-opinionated and dogmatic. So he got some negative traits there as well. But he does sound like a traditional British eccentric, a very nice fellow, a very interesting chap to talk to, who had this massive influence on London at the time, basically, and this understanding of Druidry and of these stone circles. He retained his concern with the destruction of ancient monuments, in particular the pillaging of Hadrian's Wall for stone, imploring Princess Augusta to intervene and raising the issue in a November 1757 report for the Society of Antiquaries. He also raised concerns about the sturdiness of the Eleanor Cross at Waltham Cross and ensured that it was renovated. So he's not just taking an interest in megaliths, just any ancient artifacts that we have. He wanted to preserve and prevent them from breaking down anymore for future generations. In 1757, Stukeley's second wife died, and in 1759, Stukeley purchased a cottage in the then largely rural area of Kentish Town to the north of London. In 1763, he published Paleographia Sacra, or Discourses on Sacred Subjects, as a collection of some of his Sunday sermons. In early 1765, Stukeley suffered a stroke, fell into a coma, and remained in this state for 3 days before dying in his bed on the 3rd of March. He was 77 years old. He was buried without a monument in the churchyard of St. Mary Magdalene's Church, East Ham, which he is said to have selected as his resting place on a visit there during his lifetime. So, I mean, he must have been quite a fascinating fellow to go along to and experience one of his sermons in the churches. You think he's an archaeologist, he's an anatomist, he's a philosopher, he's got this interest in religion, and he's giving these sermons in the church, which sort of tied all these interests together for the parishioners. And you can see how well liked he was by the number of people that came to see him when he was ill. You got any comments on any of that, Max?
I think what you say is perfectly correct, that he was blending different strands of study together in an interesting way, where truths could be deduced from the similarities and the common aspects of those lines of study, and in that respect, he was an exceptional man.
Well, it was a very patriotic way that he was looking at things as well. I mean, he was instilling a sense of national pride in Britain, in its archaeology and in its heritage. I mean, you have English Heritage Today, which is the organisation that preserves lots of these stone circles. And if it wasn't for Stukeley, we would never have anything like that. I mean, he was saying this is Britain's heritage. This is far more important than going out onto the continent and going to have a look at the ruins in Greece. You know, why not look at the ruins on your own doorstep? Go to Stonehenge, go to Avebury and marvel at how these things were created and what they were created for, because it shows that there was a high standard of civilization. And as we've learned since then, there was a high standard of astronomy as well, because of the way that these structures were aligned with the stars and with the sunrise and the sunset. Well, Haycock noted that Stukeley's books Stonehenge and Avebury were well received, and that scholars should not lose sight of his achievements behind the screen of his failings. He noted that Stukeley was not a lone figure hypothesizing wildly in his study, but participating in a philosophical debate that attracted the attention of various Enlightenment figures, including Isaac Newton, adding that Stukeley had established himself in a firm position in London's intellectual society. By the early 1720s, Stukeley had a growing reputation as the country's main authority on Druids and ancient monuments, having no obvious competitor, given the comparative novelty of studying stone circles. However, by the 1750s, some of Stukeley's contemporaries were criticising the accuracy of some of his plans, and some were also accusing his interpretations of being speculative. So he's sort of socialising with Isaac Newton and with the scientists of his day. So they all had an influence, one on the other. And I guess the scientific way that Newton was looking at things would have played into the way that Stukeley was looking at these druids of the past and saying, well, what were they doing when they were building these stone circles? What was it they were trying to represent here? And you can imagine that there would have been a lot of discussion about this that we probably don't have today. In the same way that people will discuss philosophy and what have you in the forums on the internet. I mean, back then you had these meetings once a week in London of the Archaeological Society and the Royal Society. You'd had these scientists there and these archaeologists and Stukeley there, and they would have been talking about these things and trying to work out what it was that our ancients believed and why it was that they were doing these things. And they were also, you know, incredibly patriotic, nothing like people today that were so self-effacing. You know, they weren't shy of saying that Britain was a leading nation in Europe, and the Britons had conquered the world and had the British Empire. These were all things that we were proud of back then, and things that Stukeley wanted to encourage in his readers, a sense of pride in what we have in Britain. Haycock observed...
One of the things I think is sort of interesting is that it took so long before somebody like Stukeley came along and said, you know, perhaps we ought to study these stone circles and read more into them than just regarding them as worthless relics of the past. You know, I think that the destruction of the stones at Avebury was particularly sort of reflects particularly badly on the people of Avebury at the time, because even today, if you happen upon the Stone Circle at Avebury, as I did. I'm not quite sure whether I've mentioned that to our listeners in the past, but you know, I just happened to discover Avebury by completely by accident. But it was that the size of the stones and the size of the Stone Circle was such that when I got home finishing my journey, I wasn't able to stay there at the time because it was the middle of the night. It was lashing down with rain. I had to get home. I was soaked through. But by the time I got home the following day, I then sort of retraced my steps to find where this place was, where these standing stones were, and then went back and visited the place, and I've visited it several times since. So, you know, the Stone Circle, both at Stonehenge and Avebury, are remarkable things that you can't see and not realise the importance of. And it's just, I find it amazing that it took to the 1700s before somebody like Stukeley came along and decided that these things ought to be protected.
Well, I guess it's like you don't realise the importance and the grandeur of your surroundings. If you were just brought up there all your life around these stones, you really wouldn't think anything of them unless you'd come across them by surprise, like you did, Max. I mean, the people that were brought up there, they just saw this as, well, this is building materials for us, isn't it? We can just smash up what's here and use it to rebuild houses. I mean, it's in a similar way, like the Romans. Roman houses were sort of smashed up and were reused. When the tide was coming in and along the beach, and there were a lot of Roman settlements that ended up being underwater. And before that would happen, the stones would all be taken apart and they'd be used for rebuilding. So I imagine it was a similar thing that was going on here. I think the same thing went on in Egypt as well. You know, they were the Arabs were taking apart the pyramids and using the stone for building material. And I think they may even have been using the papyrus, reusing these ancient papyruses that had ancient stuff that was written on them. And it was just taken for granted that this papyrus would always be there, and we could reuse it for newspapers or toilet paper or whatever. You know, we don't appreciate the value in what we have all around us sometimes. Well, Haycock observed that Stukeley's influence upon antiquarian studies for the century or so after his death was profound. For instance, in his 1796 book Indian Antiquities, Thomas Maurice drew upon Stukeley's publications as part of his argument that the Druids were a group of Indian Brahmins who had travelled west. According to Haycock, the most famous propagator of Stukeleyan ideas in the early 19th century was the artist and poet William Blake, who had read both Avebury and Stonehenge and been influenced by them. In the 19th century, many of Stukeley's interpretations were being adopted and expanded by several antiquarian clergymen, including William Lyell Bowles, D. James, and John Bathurst Dean. The Wiltshire archaeologist Richard Colt Hoare gave Stukeley's work some additional respectability when praising his use of fieldwork. Hoare concurred with Stukeley that sites such as Stonehenge and Avebury were likely Celtic, but he did not endorse the idea that they were built by Druids, believing that such information was unknowable. Of course, William Blake was an incredibly famous artist and poet. Didn't he write Jerusalem as well? I'm a big fan of William Blake's work. So he was influenced a lot by Stukeley as well. According to his biographer, Stuart Piggott, Stukeley was the central figure of early 18th century archaeology. The historian Ronald Hutton called him perhaps the most important forefather of the discipline of archaeology, while the archaeologist Paul Ashby referred to Stukeley as a pioneer unmatched in the history of archaeology. The first edition of Piggott's biography of Stukeley was published in 1950, with a revised edition released in 1985. Piggott thought him one of the most curious and complex of the English eccentrics, pathetic, charming, admirable, and laughable by turns. Pigott believed that Stukeley's folios of Avebury and Stonehenge were his most important contributions to archaeology, and he noted that the antiquarian's plan of Avebury, although failing by modern standards of accuracy, was nevertheless a very much better achievement than anything that had been produced before. Pigott's ultimate assessment was that Stukeley was not a good scholar, he was uncritical of his literary sources, and his reading was discursive rather than profound. His value to archaeology in his own day and now lies in his capacity to observe and record the facts in the open air. He situated Stukeley's intellectual failings within the wider context of British intellectual decline in the years following 1730, and Stukeley was the first person to identify the Stonehenge Avenue and the Stonehenge Cursus, giving these features the names by which they are now known. So that's interesting. So it's acknowledged that there was an intellectual decline in the years following 1730. I wonder if that was to do with the Darwinian pressures being relieved somewhat with medicine and with better sewage and with more air in the homes. Florence Nightingale, she was responsible for a lot of that, wasn't she? I was wondering if this intellectual decline coincided with that, with more people being born and making it through to adulthood rather than dying at a younger age and then going on to reproduce other people that weren't the finest examples of our type that we had at this point. Because we certainly had lots of polymaths and incredibly intelligent people around at this time. We had the Enlightenment, we had the Royal Society, we had all this new understanding of the world around us, steam and railways and the Industrial Revolution all sort of came about at the same time. And Stukeley's important role in this was to archaeology and getting us to appreciate the value of what we had around us. I think he was a wonderful eccentric. I think I'm going to try and get a copy of his biography, I think, the revised edition released in 1985. Let's hope it's not too politically correct. Max, you got any final thoughts on William Stukeley here?
I think it's really what I said a bit earlier on, that I think Stukeley, one of the remarkable things that Stukeley did was to recognise the value of preserving monuments like Stonehenge and the Avebury Stone Circle. And he was somebody in his day who saw that circle and recognised it immediately, in the same way that, you know, when I drove through Avebury that time, that I instantly recognised that there was something special about these standing stones. And also, a bit further south than Avebury was Silbury Hill. I think as you drive past Silbury Hill on the way to Devizes, for example, if you're heading that way from Swindon, the road passes very closely by the foot of Silbury Hill, and you can't drive past Silbury Hill, or in those days ride past it in a horse and carriage, without realising that there's something very remarkable about Silbury Hill. It's just not something that you would expect to see. It's not a natural phenomenon. It's obviously something that's man-made. This sort of conical mound, basically, what would appear to be perhaps a small hill, but conically shaped, with a slight flattening on the very top of it. As I say, it surprises me that it took so long for somebody like Stukeley to sort of come along and see it, and it's remarkable that Stukeley had these interests in the various threads of philosophy and religion that he was motivated to try and find commonalities and things blended those things together rather than regarded them as something that were entirely separate.
Yeah, I think looking at the size of them, I mean, it really points to the remarkable abilities of the people that built them in the first place. So it gives this sense of pride in being British, and that we built these structures and they're still standing there today thousands of years later, and it's a testament to our ancestors and to the sorts of things that we should still be coming up with today. We have to look to the past to know where we have come from and where we are going. He was certainly very patriotic minded, very nationalist minded, and he certainly did a great service to the British people in recording what he did about Avebury and Stonehenge. Thank you very much for listening, and remember to check back to RadioAlbion.com later in the year for more in our series on our greatest Britons.